Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell and today we're talking about disruption in academic publishing and why we should all care about that. Professor Ginny Barber is director of the Australasian Open Access Strategy Group and she was one of the founding editors of PLOS Medicine. She's written a perspective for the MJA in which she argues that academic publishing is on an irreversible path to change. I'm delighted to have her as my special guest today. Open access, why is this something that your average GP needs to think about?
The key imperative behind open access is making sure that anyone who needs to get access to any type of research, particularly medical research, can get access to it. Obviously, if you're sitting in a well-financed university, that's not so much of a problem, but most doctors aren't. And so really, this is about ensuring that, you know, your average GP can read what they need to as well as anyone else who's sitting at a university, for example.
We're living in a fairly difficult age for publishing, but particularly academic journals are coming to a crunch point, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that they've been going through a crunch time for quite some time.
Yeah.
It's probably becoming more, it's probably getting more to the point where we're understanding what the future needs to look like. And that makes me quite hopeful, actually. So it used to be that open access was really just about free access. Can you just read a PDF of a journal article, for example, as opposed to reading it in a bound journal? But now what we're talking really is about what the future might look like. A fully interoperable, interconnected set of research, so which includes, for example, you know, you might want to be able to look at the data behind a paper. You might want to look at the protocol. If it's a clinical trial, you might want to look at the registration documents. All of that stuff can be seamlessly linked together nowadays. And that's really what full open access looks like. It's not just a replication of the journal in hard copy. It's about exploiting the full potential of the internet to make openness a reality, really.
How are academic journals taking that problem on, or are they burying their heads in the sand still a bit?
No, I think there's a whole range of approaches. So there are some really innovative publishing approaches. So, for example, things like F1000, where you essentially post one version of an article, it gets peer-reviewed openly and publicly. You can post subsequent versions of it, and that's all linked to underlying data. And that, for example, is actually the model that the Wellcome Trust and the Gates Foundation have based their own journals on.
Yes.
So that's really, you know, very important within medical research and is likely to become increasingly important. Through to journals which are really still just online and maybe free to read, but haven't yet figured out the business model for making things fully open.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you would be struggling to find any journal, I think, nowadays that doesn't have some sort of an online presence. And part of it is the background to the where those journals came from, and part of it is responding to the needs of particular communities. So, for example, in genetics, there's been a very long history of putting information online and linking it to gene sequences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's been standard practice for, you know, 20 years now.
What has caused the disruption that's happening now? What has changed in the last 20 years, say, that is making the subscription model now not be adequate?
Well, I think there are three things going on. So the first one is the fact that we've got the internet. So the sort of the basic internet was really the driver behind all of this. There's no question that, you know, we realised very early on that we could just put things online, and that already made it easier for many more people to read it. The second one, unquestionably, is the issue around cost. The big deals where bundles of journals were sold at what have become increasingly high prices, mm-hmm. and you're way above the cost of inflation, has led a lot of journals to think about what they're purchasing,
yep.
what they really should be purchasing, whether or not they can actually afford all of these bundles or whether they need them all. But the third one, and the more interesting one, as I said, is the associated technology, which means that we can link things together. So, for example, if you're an academic nowadays, you should have an ORCID ID and that uniquely links you to all of your publications. Every article online has a permanent identifier, a DOI, and even parts of journals and parts of articles have DOIs. Everything can be linked together, and it becomes a much more living ecosystem rather than a static one. So I think there's a lot of complex things going on, and all of those are playing into why we're seeing open access become more possible and actually more desirable than obviously it was, you know, 20 years ago.
The obvious question is, publishing is cheap, producing content is not. How do we pay our journalists, editors, office staff, if we're not getting money from subscriptions?
Well, you know, as we all know, the subscription model is an increasingly hard one to maintain across many industries, not just medical publishing. You know, just look at the journals and newspapers, for example. Actually, what happens with turning the model around so that instead of paying every time somebody accesses something, ensuring that the payment at the time of something goes online, you can turn the whole business model around. And there's a whole load of economic work that's been done, particularly in Europe, for example, from the Max Planck Institute, that it is possible to do this. There is enough money in the system to do that, but it's not going to all come from the same place. So, for example, the idea that academic libraries will be the only places that can support journals, that clearly isn't going to work. They may not have enough money from particular institutions. And thinking of the money within silos also doesn't work. What you have to do is to think of a sort of national approach or even an international approach and say, well, how do we support the infrastructure for dissemination of research? And let's not just think about it at the time of the individual article or the individual journal, think about it as a whole ecosystem. So there's a number of initiatives going on nowadays to look at the investment that's needed in the open infrastructure and say, well, let's think about the flows of money to make sure that whatever money we need comes into the system early on. That requires big strategic approaches, and that's one of the things that the group that I work for, the Australasian Open Access Strategy Group, and for example the Council of Australian University Librarians, we've called for that on a national level in Australia, and we'd like to see the government taking a whole of country strategic approach to this.
How have the government reacted to that so far?
Well, there's a couple of inquiries that led to this. So the first one was the Productivity Commission inquiry into intellectual property back in 2016. And that called for a national open access approach. And the government did actually accept that policy approach, but they haven't implemented it. So that's 2017. And 2018, the House of Representatives had an inquiry actually into the funding of research. And one of their recommendations was that the government develop a strategic approach to open scholarship, which we had put forward in our submission, and we were highly delighted to see that there. But we're now waiting to see how the current government, how they'll respond to that. But we'd like to see a national approach to open scholarship, and we hope that it'll be part of the discussions within this next parliament.
Does open scholarship improve the quality and reproducibility of research?
That's right. I mean, that's another key driver here. So I talked a little bit about the idea of having underlying data. Clearly, if you can access underlying data, you can have more confidence in the result of that research. Yep. Or if you can see revisions, or if you can see the peer review process, all of that being open makes it easier to have confidence in the research. We talk a lot about the reproducibility crisis. You might hear that particularly in basic science. Clinical science, well, there's probably many of the same issues. And in fact, the National Health and Medical Research Council is currently leading a project on research quality. There's a steering group that I'm part of. And one of the key parts of that will be thinking about, dissemination of research. But the quality of research, that's a multifaceted thing. And it starts everywhere from the culture of where the research is done in the first place through to how well people are trained in methodology of the research that they do. But clearly, the more exposure the different parts of the process get, the more confidence you can have in it. And then the bit that's also linked to that is making sure that people have incentives for doing good research, rewarding people for sharing data, rewarding them for making their code open, rewarding them for the types of good practice that makes research more reproducible is really important.
And how do we reward them for that? Is it a financial thing? Is it a promotional thing? What is the incentive?
A large part of it is moving away from the idea that the only incentive you have as an academic is publishing in certain journals. It's really important to say, journal-based metrics, rewarding people based on that is a terrible way to incentivize practice that can be problematic. It's a real perverse incentive. But for example, saying, well, if you make your data open and you have it, it can be something that's cited, that can be very powerful in grant applications, for example, and funders can send a specific signal that they value that if they allow that to be part of grant application. Quite a few institutions, not in Australia so much, but abroad, are beginning to say, well, show us when you apply, what are your open scholarship practices? if you're an academic medical researcher, well, obviously things like ensuring that all the clinical trials, if you do a clinical trial, that must be registered. You must have a process for managing the data behind it. All of that sort of thing can be something that you can reward. It's not just the final output, the publication.
The journal impact factor, is that a good incentive or an unhelpful one in the world of open access?
It's a pretty poor marker of anything, really. I mean, it's not even a very good marker of a journal overall. We know it only counts a certain number of articles. So,
indeed.
For example, it doesn't count all the journal articles. It can be manipulated by editors and publishers. It's a delayed metric, so it doesn't even count things in the last year. So it's really problematic as a long-term or even a really short-term marker of the quality of the journal. And it tells you, of course, nothing about an individual article within that journal and even less about an individual researcher. So one of the things that I've been involved in, certainly when I worked at the Public Library of Science and before that, we really kicked off the idea of article-level metrics, so counting individual downloads, individual citations, wider impact as well. And I think that's becoming much more of something that people are much more aware of and much more understanding of the importance of taking a range of metrics to understand about the quality of a particular article.
Do you find a lot of resistance along those lines when you have these discussions with journals and editors?
Change is hard work, whichever industry you're in. But I'm a sort of permanent optimist, and like you, I've been in this for a long time. I started at PLOS in 2003, so I've been thinking about this for quite a long time. I think we went through a really difficult phase where I think very early on everybody thought this was going to be really easy, just blindingly obvious, and we'd just flip all the journals over and that would be that. Then there was a period in the middle where I think a lot of traditional publishers in particular felt very threatened, and there was a really difficult phase, I think, where they were pushing back against the innovation, and I think we didn't have the technological side of it to really exploit and develop open access properly. And now what we're seeing, I think, is much more of a concerted political will. So things such as Plan S, which is coming from Europe, individual countries saying actually, such as Sweden, Finland, a number of countries within Europe saying, actually, we really do want this to happen. So this is how we're going to approach it from a national strategic approach. Big institutions such as the University of California saying, this is really important. We think that we want to make this happen. And I think at the same time, there's this understanding that we're moving from sort of a complex closed ecosystem to a complex open ecosystem. So there's going to be different flavours. There will still be journals, for example, that publish opinion pieces under subscriptions. I pay for the Guardian, to publish its work, and then it makes it open because other people support it. There may well be op-ed pieces that will always be behind paywalls, and I think that's okay. But for original research, for the research that really underpins clinical practice, I just think it's blindingly obvious that has to be open to everybody to access. And it's interesting, for example, if you look at funders like the Wellcome Trust in the UK, they're going a step further. Not only do they support open access publishing in lots of journals, they have their own open access journal. And they're now saying, if you are doing work on, say, an emerging epidemic such as Ebola, you must make your work available via a preprint. So they really see very clearly that there's a clear imperative for research to be immediately open. And I think that's the direction that we're going. But for other areas, you might say, well, there won't be such an imperative, and so there'll be a different system.
I'm chatting today with Ginny Barber, Professor and Advisor to the Office of Research Ethics and Integrity at Queensland University of Technology. Her perspective can be found at mja.com.au, where it is open access. You can also find all our podcasts on the website, or you can subscribe to our iTunes feed to have them delivered to your device every weekend. Back to our chat. What about authors paying to be gold access, open access? Is that a good thing?
I mean, gold open access is not just author pays. It's probably better to call it journal-based open access. It includes journals where there are no article processing charges. And most of the journals, for example, that are in the directory of open access journals don't have an article processing charge. It's pretty clear that it should not be individual researchers that are paying brought to public in any journal. And that's the core principle of Plan S, for example, which is that it will be the funders and institutions that will pay the costs of article processing charges. Clearly, we don't have those systems in place at the moment, but that's the future that we're working towards. The idea will be there needs to be money to support publishing. Some of it will be in journals where an article processing charge is needed. Sometimes, for example, you might expect institutions to support open access journals just and absorb those costs, and that's what happens. There are quite a few journals at universities that are free to read and free to publish in. Maybe that funders do that. So the Wellcome Trust is an example of it support its own open access journal. The future is not going to be individual researchers paying for open access. It's going to be paid on either consortial or a national or even an international level, I think.
How are the publishers reacting to this? I mean, in your article you say that 70% of the world's journals are owned by a small group of publishers now, the Elseviers, the Wileys, et cetera, et cetera. How are they reacting to this disruptive time, and how are they helping or not helping the process?
I think the last couple of years in particular have seen something of a change in their approach. I think early on they thought this was all a passing fad, it's going to go away. Not really. I think there was quite a long period in the middle where they fought it tooth and nail, to be honest. And, you know, we know that a lot of the things that happened in that time really, I think, did hold us back quite dramatically. But with things like Plan S, with things like whole countries saying, this is what we want to do, I think the publishers, particularly at least the ones who realise that they are providing service, have actually said, OK, we'll have them do that. And so you're, for example, beginning to see things like publish and read agreements convert subscription-only publishing with the added cost of article processing charges combined into one deal with both access and publish. And the long-term aim really is to convert all of that into potentially allowing the authors to publish wherever they like, with the cost being underwritten by the institution and the authors not having to pay any article processing charges. It's complex though. At the same time, what we're also seeing is the countries and institutions that have managed to begin to negotiate these deals, there's a lot of sharing amongst them of how they did that. Best practice is beginning to emerge. And I think the publishers, at least smart ones, can see the writing on the wall, and they are engaging with institutions that want to do this. I see that, again, it's not going to be an overnight transition, but we're clearly going in the right direction.
Which journals are doing it right at the moment?
It's not really happening on an individual journal level. I think all of the publishers are taking steps in some directions. I think, you know, while in Springer Nature, they're beginning to offer deals. Smaller publishers are also doing the same thing. It's hard for an individual journal, I would say, to negotiate this on their own, apart from the born OA ones, which obviously have their own business models. I think we are going to continue to see an important role for publishers in negotiating for the whole of their journals, I think, rather than happening individually.
What about the journals that are society-backed or association-backed? How do they survive this and how do they thrive?
There's going to have to be negotiations about how individual journals and societies manage. Right now, of course, we do know that a lot of the subscriptions that come for individual journals may go to support other activities.
Yes.
So they might support conferences or they might support scholarships, all of which are entirely worthy things to happen. Maybe those things can't be covered anymore from the cost of publishing a journal. And you could argue, well, they are separate activities. If it's really appropriate that a society supports scholarships, well, they may have to get that from other models. And that may well be from individual institutions. It's just that institutions have in the past have sort of supported that through subscriptions. Yeah. In the future, they might support them through more direct costs. Let's not forget that I talked about a complex future system. Some of it may well be that open access happens through green open access, through a repository-based open access. So some journals may continue to charge subscriptions, but the work becomes open access through an institutional repository. The role of repositories is very interesting here, and I think is going to become important to certain disciplines. And I certainly think for some time at least, there are going to be journals that choose to be open access through that route, and that may well be an acceptable long-term vision for some journals. I think it's not simple, but for journals to talk with people who work at society journals, I would just say that you need to be thinking about what your future is now, because particularly if Plan S becomes a global model, if it's adopted by funders elsewhere, it will be very important for journals to be able to say to their authors, look, we have a model. This is how you can comply with this through our journal. This is what you do. And if it's through article processing charges, covered by institutions, that's great, or if it's through institutional repositories, that's also okay. But the status quo is not going to be something that is going to be acceptable for very much longer. Plan S is intended to come into place. Research organisations that are supporting it in Europe, they're looking to implement it by 2021, and there'll be a review in 2024. So it's a relatively short time frame.
Where do predatory journals fit in this? Are they rubbing their hands together?
Predatory journals, they are clearly an unfortunate part of the publishing landscape nowadays. But I mean, I tend to view them as a sort of part of a whole spectrum. You know, there are very selective journals that do a large amount of editorial work, lots of copy editing, that's very hands-on. And then there's the predatory journals at one end that are simply basically either putting your stuff online with no peer review, or they're pretending they're doing peer review and are not actually doing that. And then in the middle, there's a very wide range of journals, some of which offer increasing amounts of editorial work. The key thing, I think, for researchers is to understand where they're publishing. And the same is also true, I think, for readers. Initiatives such as Think, Check, Submit are incredibly important because it says to people, look, you know, have a think about where you're publishing. Have you heard about this journal? Do your colleagues publish there? If you're an early career researcher, does your supervisor know about it? And if the answer to all of those questions is no, why on earth are you either submitting there or reading articles which were within that journal? You need to apply critical sense. The same critical sense you apply to research has to be applied to where you publish your research and where you read. And I think that in many ways, the predatory journals have served a useful function in some ways, because I hope they've begun to alert authors to the need to be really careful, scrutinised venues of publication. And I'd like to see that built in much more to training programmes. This is a common thing that I hear, which is that a lot of people just slightly panic when presented with the publishing landscape nowadays.
Yes.
It's just too complicated. And I think it's a really important job of people like me who work in information and librarians and, you know, journal editors too, to really say, okay, this is a boiled down basics around publishing. These are the things that you need to know, and these are your, you know, use your options when you come to publish. But I think it's a two-way thing. I'd like to see authors asking more questions.
Yes.
But absolutely, we need to be pushing more information out. And there is a lot of information out there, but it tends to be that everybody, you need it at the time that you need it. It's not something you're thinking, if you're an academic, you're not necessarily thinking about this all the time. So one of the things that my group is hoping to do more of is to make sure that there's information there when you need it immediately, whether you get it through the library or you get it through other websites, but as an academic, you can easily get research, the information in.
If you had a magic wand, Ginny, what would you do right now that would take us a big step forward?
In Australia, I think the most important thing would be to say to the government, we need a national approach to open scholarship. We need to be really clear that we're being strategic, that we understand what the needs are across the entire academic landscape, but also particularly for GPs, for doctors working elsewhere, but academics in a range of disciplines, understand what their information needs are and make sure that we've got a properly funded strategic approach that addresses all of their needs. That would be my magic wand. But it's a massively exciting time. That would be my overwhelming message. But also there are people out there that can help. So I'm not a librarian by background, but I work with librarians day to day. And I cannot emphasise enough the importance of academic librarians nowadays. And I would just say to anybody that is trying to figure out their way through this, find your local librarian and get them to help you, because they are the really key information professionals nowadays.
Thank you, Ginny.
You're welcome.
I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.